ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The Economy Stupid is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's summer and that means I am revisiting some of your favourite stories from 2025. Today we're looking into diversity and inclusion in sport. Coming up, Australia was gripped by Tilly fever during the Women's World Cup, but now the dust has settled. Has that enthusiasm had a lasting impact on our love of women's sport? Plus the incredible world of vision-impaired marathon runners and what life lessons we can take from extreme sport. But first, have you ever wondered what the fittest version of yourself would look like? It's the promise of bodybuilding competitions. How much muscle could you build? How lean could you get? These competitions are increasing in popularity, especially among women, but they can also be a gateway to some unhealthy practices. According to a recent study, women in bodybuilding are four times as likely than average to use anabolic steroids, which help your body build muscle. One in seven are using these drugs. They are illegal, but they are also unregulated and very often mislabeled, meaning it's unclear what you're putting into your body. In a moment, you'll hear from a bodybuilder who says she's seen the worrying effects firsthand. But to start off, I'm joined by Dr. Tim Pietkowski, who's a harm reduction researcher at Griffith University with a special focus on steroid use. Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What are these steroids?
So when we talk about anabolic steroids, we're talking about testosterone and the synthetic derivatives. So things like nandrolone, you might have heard tren or trenbolone thrown around a lot.
I haven't, but...
our listeners might. And so they help you to accrue muscle tissue, stay in a positive nitrogen balance and put on size and strength with slightly different effects depending on what steroid you're taking.
Do they work differently on female bodies than they do on male bodies?
Well, so I guess at a cellular level, you know, we're talking about positive nitrogen balance and tissue accretion. I guess for women, the difference is that they have a different ratio of testosterone production, and the primary, hormone production is estrogen and progesterone. And so really there's some other changes that are more concerning for women. So not only do they have to worry about the significant risk of heart failure, stroke, liver damage, things like cholestasis, polyatosis.
I don't know what those words mean.
bad liver, explode, rupture, pain, hospital, and kidney strain. But they also have to worry about the virilization, so masculinizing side effects. So for when we talk about androgens or anabolic androgenic steroids, we can't actually separate those effects from each other. The androgenic component is what gives you the male characteristics, and the anabolic component is what does the tissue accretion. And so for women, there are this swathe of other side effects that they do need to be concerned about: facial hair growth, hair loss, voice changes, which can be permanent. They tend to, my research will show, they tend to experience acne at a slightly higher level as well. And obviously the really significant one is permanent infertility.
Okay, so not reversible changes, not the sort of things that are just going to go back to baseline if you stop taking them after your comp or whatever.
No. Some of this stuff is for life.
Where is the pressure coming from? A lot of the research that you've done is on the actual drugs themselves and what they might be doing, but a big part of it is about trends and communities that are more likely to be using steroids than others. What do you think might be behind what seems to be an uptick in women, especially in bodybuilding?
So I think we have a few drivers. Hey, I think particularly for a while we've had certain body ideals propagated to us through media and now very much through social media. And those ideals used to be skinny for women and big, bulky for men. Some of the newer research I've been doing has been looking at the convergence of those ideals. So both men and women want not only lean, so low body fat, but a highly muscular appearance, so a more fit ideal. And so that convergence, I guess, is one driver. Then we've got this wonderful, you know, exposure 24/7 on our phones to fitness influencers and beautiful bodies all the time. And then we have an unprecedented level of access to an unregulated market where we can go onto Amazon and I can buy a bottle of testosterone right now.
Someone who's seen what steroids can do and says she's even felt pressure to do them herself is bodybuilder Jazz Patterson. She's an IFBB bikini competitor and bodybuilding coach, and she joins me now. Hi, Jazz.
Hi, Tegan. How are you going?
I'm good. So we're hearing from Tim about what steroids can do. What's your experience been in the spheres that you're moving in?
Yeah, it's definitely been something that I've noticed an increase in awareness of, I guess, with the female bodybuilders that I work with. It's, I guess there is a lot less taboo-ness, for lack of a better word, around it now, where people are talking about it more openly. And I guess that while there are obviously the negative impacts of social media and pressures and propagandas and things that can come with that, I think one of the positives that can be taken from the fact that more people are talking about it now and it is becoming a little bit more normalized is that there are more people giving out some information on how women can go about using performance-enhancing drugs in ways that would really hope to minimize the negative side effects or the more masculine side effects. So I think there is, you know, with everything, there's ends of the extreme and there's people who take things way too far in every area of life. But I think, yeah, steroid use and steroid use specifically among females can, yeah, definitely fall somewhere within that spectrum. So it depends. It really depends on what kind of steroid use we are talking about, but I definitely have seen more interest in females wanting to consider using things like steroids.
Tim, I think we should probably just draw a line in the sand here. What does the law say about using these drugs in Australia?
So in Australia, well, here where we are right now in Queensland, they are a Schedule 1 drug, same as heroin or methamphetamine, and you face I guess up to 25 years in prison for possessing them. In New South Wales, similar laws and penalties apply. And then in Victoria, it's a little bit looser with, I think, 1 year being the threat.
And because they're unregulated, because they're illegal, they're unregulated, which means often what you think you're buying isn't what you're actually getting.
Correct. So we know from some other research that I've done through the steroid checking trial we ran here in Queensland, we know that out of over 100 samples we tested, which were submitted by community, including men and women from around, that over 25% of those were a different steroid than what the person thought they were going to get. And 50% or more were actually underdosed, so less steroid than intended, about 6.9% overdosed.
Jazz, we heard from you before saying that you said there's less stigma around, there's maybe more people talking openly about using it. What do you think has created this shift in culture in bodybuilding?
Well, I definitely, like you said at the start, bodybuilding has become incredibly popular, especially among women. Like a couple of decades ago, there was nothing existing that was like the female IFBB bikini look. Like there was just bodybuilding and it was mostly masculine, and females who participated in bodybuilding were looking kind of like men, like the very, very big, very jacked, very muscular look. It's definitely more of a recent thing where females have been, well, these categories have been created within bodybuilding where females are encouraged to achieve a more feminine look, like the bikini category, for example, within IFBB. It's something that I think draws a lot of attention for women. Like we obviously would like to look and feel our best, and participating in a bodybuilding comp and achieving a goal that seems, you know, somewhat realistic and doesn't seem to just put women into this category of having to look ridiculously muscular like it used to, can be very attractive. So I think in that sense, there's definitely been more of a draw towards doing bodybuilding and bodybuilding comps. And I've noticed that even in the work that I do with bodybuilding coaching, there are a lot more people who are more interested in doing bodybuilding now, not necessarily because it's going to achieve this huge muscular look, but because it can, it can give the impression that it's going to help you achieve the physique that you would really like.
Jazz, I know on your social media, you're really upfront about the fact that the way that someone looks on comp day isn't a long-term realistic body to look for. What are sort of some of the pitfalls of social media that you've seen?
In the sense of bodybuilding and being that lean?
Yeah, and just in terms of what people think is realistic and achievable.
I think one of the biggest pitfalls is, competitors like myself, I think it's very, very, very easy to want to present yourself as someone who always seems to have this perfect control and perfect physique and is able to maintain this discipline and lean body fat percentage and muscularity. Like we like to present ourselves as these very put together, very almost perfect idealistic bodybuilders, because that is what sells and that is what people are drawn to. That's what gets you followers and likes and honestly will get you business as well. If you are a coach, I think one of the things that I've really learned over my years in the bodybuilding world and just social media in general is that there's nothing true about that for me personally, and I would say for a lot of other competitors like myself, there is nothing realistic about always holding yourself to the standard of I'm always lean, I'm always disciplined, I'm basically like not human, I'm this robot who operates out of this place of just being able to get everything right all the time. And something that has been a major pitfall that I've been trying to speak more into on my social media is the fact that bodybuilders and women in particular, we need it to be more normal that we are also human and that we are going to gain body fat, and that we, like you, if you aren't a bodybuilder, we too have bad days with body image, even when we are shredded. We too have days where we may not work as hard in the gym. We are just as human as everyone else. And I think that kind of taking ourselves off that pedestal is something that is really desperately needed in the bodybuilding industry in general. And honestly, like to even loop this back to steroid use and PED use, I think if more people were very just honest and more realistic about who they are and how they're actually going, instead of presenting a version of themselves that they think the world wants to see, I think we would see less people feeling inclined to go the PED route. Everyone would kind of hopefully start to see that we can look awesome and be great and also be human at the same time without needing to go into those extremes.
Tim, it sounds like the picture's so much more complicated than just people using steroids. It's really wrapped up in body image, as we're hearing Jazz say there. Is education about steroids alone really the way to address this problem?
Two things. And I'm going to take a step back first. I think we've spoken a lot about negative things. Also want to very much acknowledge women who are doing strength sports. Incredibly amazing, powerful, doing awesome stuff. 300 kilo squats, 600, 700 kilo totals, like super amazing things, looking fantastic. And we can't ignore the positive benefits either. And the idea of, I guess, there's a level of balance and autonomy and people having ability to make well-informed decisions
while participating in strength-based sports.
Yeah. And if PED and steroid use is part of that, then it is part of it for the people that want to participate, right? And there are other people who don't participate in that. And I think, you know, we have to give people their full humanity and decision-making in that. I think on the education...
That's not very don't do drugs of you to say that.
It isn't very don't do drugs of me. And this is my lead-in and segue for coming back to your original point. I think there are some fantastic influencers, coaches and other people out there that are doing... open, transparent, honest discussions about here is my workout plan, here is my diet, here are my supplements, and here's the drugs I take. and not encourage it, just to give you the full picture of what's happening. And with that full picture, people are able to make a more realistic decision about what it takes to look a particular way. Because if you don't talk about the steroids, if you don't talk about the other things that are happening, then very, very confusing if you don't know what the extra ingredient is.
So I'm thinking about someone who's listening who has a young person in their life or someone they care a lot about, and they're seeing them on a path, perhaps, concerned about maybe them taking, seeing someone who looks awesome, knowing that drugs are part of that, illegal drugs. How do we come together with an openness and transparency and also not be promoting it?
Mm. So I think this idea of open, honest communication, this idea of safer use models for people that have already engaged or made the decision to engage with these drugs is very important. So we have a service here, Steroid Connect, as part of Queensland Injectors' Voice for Advocacy in Action. We have a steroid peer educator, ex-bodybuilder, who provides phone line, online and also in-person harm reduction advice and safer use administration, things like that, does training for workforce, all kinds of things to, I guess, find that middle space. For those who are considering use, or perhaps, you know, already doing the behaviours that we know correlate with the next step towards risky substance use, I suppose it does still fit in, this idea of safer use. So putting the use off until you've fully developed, using at a clinical or slightly super clinical dose, using a regulated product. There are things that we can do that actually minimise harm, because a lot of the harms that we see come from very, very high doses, unregulated products, structural harms like stigma, those types of things. We can actually cut a lot of that out, encourage health monitoring, taking blood pressure, doing echocardiograms, blood tests, things like that, and I guess create a space where there's good health and social outcomes, while also, I guess, adding that prevention element for our younger generations who probably shouldn't be doing steroids at 15, let's be honest. But I guess if they move into bodybuilding and want to compete one day, perhaps at age 30, when they're fully developed, both in terms of body, brain, organ systems, that might be a decision that they want to make, and let's help them make that decision well.
So you talked about a harm reduction program called Steroid Connect. That's not everywhere in Australia at the moment.
No, just in Queensland. There was a previous service that operated in Victoria, Steroid Peer Education Program, that was recently defunded, unfortunately. We currently operate the only one here in Queensland. And just shameless plug, I guess, we, you know, this is a part of a research program that I lead, but also we need these programs everywhere, not just Queensland. We need steroid peer educators in every state and territory, because we know that there is a very high prevalence of accessibility out there, and that people are being drawn to these substances. So we need to keep them safer.
So if people want to educate themselves, if they're worried about someone or they're worried about themselves, what's a good place with high quality information that they can go to?
Fantastic. So buttressing Steroid Connect, we have a online site called High Ground. It's an initiative run by Quiver, the organisation that I'm on the board of. And in partnership, we develop harm reduction and safer use materials. So things like safer injecting guides, things like some of the recent evidence podcasts that we do with social media influencers and high-level coaches, athletes, and other bits and pieces like that. There's a whole repository of resources and information, as well as some of the research that I do and other colleagues have done.
Tim, thanks so much for sharing your insights today.
Thanks.
And thanks also, Jazz Patterson.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, remember when the entire country became an overnight Matildas fan? Did Tilly Fever actually translate to broader support for women's sport?
Christopher Skase was charming,
audacious,
powerfully charismatic.
Christopher Skase had it all. A beautiful wife, great hair, and a $1 billion empire. It's almost as if it was...
too good to be true.
Too good to be true.
Well, it was.
The largest corporate collapse in Australian history.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just a few years ago, the whole nation was white-knuckled, hand-in-hand, barracking for the Matildas. Tilly fever had the whole country sweating on women's soccer, and it wasn't just a vibe, the numbers backed it up. Their World Cup semi-final match shattered TV ratings records. But now the dust has settled, how's support for women's leagues in Australia holding up? Because critics say poor infrastructure, ill-informed leadership and bad media coverage are stifling growth, with flow-on effects hitting community sport at the grassroots level. So what's the solution? Well, I'm joined now by a former Tilly. Moya Dodd is the former vice-captain of the Matildas and current secretary to the board of the Women's League Forum. Moya, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, thanks for having me.
Tell me about the role of the Women's League Forum.
Oh, the Women's Leagues Forum convenes the emerging professional women's football leagues around the world, and we share best practice and gather common interests and advocate to stakeholders to help grow the leagues.
Do we need to be thinking about sport as a business in a different way when we're looking at women's leagues and trying to compare them to men's sports?
I think historically women's sport has been thought of as a kind of add-on, as a poor relation to men's sport, but it's now emerging very much in its own right as a commercially valuable and viable proposition. I mean, there's still plenty to do, but there are some extraordinary examples of growth and success from around the world, particularly in women's football, where, for example, the US League, the NWSL, had an astronomical valuation growth in its clubs. The last club that changed hands was Angel City for $250 million. It didn't exist 6 years ago. And their last broadcast deal was 40 times the size of its previous one. It's now on $60 million a year. So these sorts of examples show what can be achieved if there is a focus on the women's game and if the right expertise is brought to bear.
So it's interesting you're talking about TV figures there, because I mentioned at the beginning that figure of the Tilly smashing TV ratings records. How does coverage of a sport translate to fan engagement?
Oh, well, the coverage feeds the fan engagement, of course. I mean, historically, fans of women's sport couldn't just turn on the telly and switch channels and, you know, find a good women's game happening somewhere. They'd have to go hunting for it online. They'd be getting their information off digital media. So they're very digitally native, actually, the fans of women's sport, which makes them more valuable. But I think that where traditional media can do better is by, well, firstly, covering it, because so little of traditional media coverage is devoted to women's sport. But secondly, speaking to the new fans of the sport. I mean, there are so many new fans of women's football and of women's sport in Australia who've emerged over the last 5 years or so. They need to be spoken to in a way that's not necessarily the same as, you know, commentary of men's sport has been conducted for years. There was a really interesting study in the UK, actually, after the last World Cups, and they measured how many people watched the Men's World Cup in Qatar, and they got to about 50 million in the UK. Then they looked at how many watched the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand, and they got to about 30 million. And of those 30 million, about 20 million were overlaps with people who'd watched the Men's World Cup. But incredibly, there were more than 11 million people in the UK who watched the Women's World Cup who did not watch the Men's World Cup. Now, I wouldn't have thought you could find more than half a dozen Poms who liked football and hadn't watched the Men's World Cup, but there they were, 11 million new football supporters who watched the women's and didn't watch the men's.
You're saying we need to talk to people differently or commentate differently. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think if you go to a women's sport event, you feel a different vibe. I mean, I think with every sporting event, fans go to watch a great sporting spectacle. They want to see, you know, big goals, flying tackles. They want to see all the sporting excellence that they, you know, have come to expect from professional athletes. But I think with women's sport, there are other dimensions that are really important as well. People come to celebrate what they think women's sport stands for. And those things are gender equality, they are women's empowerment, and it's a sense of social inclusion. People often comment about how safe they feel at a women's sport event. They feel welcome. They don't feel like they'll be ridiculed if they sort of shout the wrong thing. There's almost never any violence or, racism or terrible things being shouted from the terraces. In women's sport, that is so rare. It's almost like a new, it's sort of sport without the ugly bits, if I can put it that way.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. We're talking about women's sport and why some leagues seem to have really be thriving and getting some great deals and lots of fan engagement and others not so much. I'm also joined by Hans Vesterbeek, who's a professor of international sport business at Victoria University. Hans, you've looked at TV ratings compared to crowd attendance in the AFLW. Can you tell me what you found there?
Yeah. Good morning. Well, obviously, the AFLW launched with a bang in 2017, and certainly was incredibly well received in the starting years. Then a thing happened called COVID, and ever since COVID. Unfortunately, the numbers have gone down, both in terms of attendance and viewership on free-to-air broadcast. And I guess I can echo some of the comments of Moya in terms of the choices that you make as an organization. Do you take it 100% serious, and do you invest, and is there vision behind the investment, or is it more hoping that, you know, after a successful launch, you will continue to be successful?
A couple of weeks ago, we saw the GWS Giants come out saying they were disappointed by the lack of double headers between the men's and women's team. What do double headers do for a women's club fan base?
Well, I think the bigger picture really is, and I want to go back again to what Moya said about the product, you know, the product of female professional sport versus male professional sport, in particular in relation to football codes. You can't really say they are the same product, and therefore you also cannot treat them the same in terms of how you position them, how you market them. And to that extent, I think a double header is just a marketing tool to lift on the exposure that the male game already has, and therefore it is a tool to increase awareness and exposure of the female game and show to a public that maybe otherwise wouldn't go to an AFLW match what the quality of that match is, create a level of interest that makes people more likely to go to a standalone match. But a double header is really a step in the process towards more marketing exposure. But it is also a step in the strategy of creating an independent product that can stand on its own. And, you know, again, like Moya said, it may be promoted for different reasons to potentially different segments in the market, although there will be a great overlap as well. If you like the men's game, you also will like the female game for the amazing skills that the athletes perform on the field.
Moya, how have double headers worked with the A-League in Australia?
There have been a lot of double headers over the years in the A-Leagues, and they have served to introduce women's football to an audience that whose primary interest is men's football. But I think, as Hans said, it's a step to a different end game. There was some interesting segmentation work done by the WSL in England, and they concluded that they had three sorts of fans. They had the hardcore women's football fans who were like rusted on forever. There were the what they called secondary fans who started with an interest in men's football and then got a kind of a side interest in women's football, but it's a secondary thing for them. And there are a lot of those fans in England, as you can imagine. If you're a fan of Arsenal or Chelsea or Liverpool, you might take an interest in their women's team. And then there were the newbie fans who were relatively new to the game and did not come from men's sport. They were just fans of women's sport. And actually, all three segments there make up their audience. So I'm sure you'll find something very similar in Australia. Double headers are useful to expose the game to an existing audience. But I think we should be more ambitious than that. We should be looking to get new fans who are different and who will grow the overall market. That makes a lot of sense for an integrated club to do that.
Hans, your research has also looked at how good investment in the professional codes flows onto grassroots community support. What do we know?
Well, first of all, I think a general statement here is that both in terms of professional leagues and major events, there's not a direct correlation between being exposed to the elite game and people starting to play. Certainly not with pulsating events like the Olympics. You know, there might be a little spike after an event like that, but it doesn't really lead to ongoing engagement. So it really is important that those clubs that have elite parts to their clubs or indeed leagues that are professional leagues, those that are integrated with community sport are the ones that are most likely to be successful because they can provide a whole supply chain all the way from grassroots development programs to attendance and viewership at the pro part of the game. And I think, you know, if we take the AFL as an example, in the initial foundation of the national game, the AFL, they kind of separated the elite part of the game from grassroots, and only down the track started realizing if you don't invest in the grassroots, then you also don't have an elite product. So it's less a top-down approach, and it's more a bottom-up approach in that, you know, if you don't feed your community sports system, then, you know, your elite part of the game will suffer as well. And just allow me to quickly sidestep to an emerging sports system such as India, where really there's hardly any community organized sports, certainly not the beautiful systems that we have in Australia and many European countries, club-based community sport. If you start a pro league, then you only have a pro league.
Yeah.
And if there's no infrastructure at the community level to start feeding, you know, young people into the system that ultimately will go and play in your pro league, then the system's still not complete. So I think the most important observation here is that you cannot separate the top from the bottom.
Mm. Kate says on the text line, I was chatting to a dad from the opposing girls team at my daughter's under 13 soccer game about women's sport. And he says he's now women's sport so good, he often prefers it. Kate says, as a middle-aged woman, I never would have dreamt my daughter could play local club soccer, especially in a girls team. So Moya, it really does sound like women's sports are really helping boost engagement at the grassroots level.
Grassroots sport in Australia, and especially football, it goes gangbusters. I mean, there are just so many people who want to play that there aren't enough facilities to hold them. It's actually a challenge to find the spaces to play. I think the thing that has made the big difference, though, for the Matildas over the last decade is that there has been an emerging pathway into professionalism, so that instead of being, you know, part-time players or amateur players, as I was when I was in the Matildas, you know, you work 5 days a week, you go to train in the evenings and you play on the weekends. And, you know, these days the Matildas are full-time professionals playing in professionalised clubs in good daily training environments with good coaches, you know, good dietitians, psychologists, etc. And they're playing in professional leagues. And that, you know, becoming a full-time athlete is the key to the phenomenal growth in their performance, I think. So it's actually building out the pathway from the grassroots through to professional clubs and leagues and then into, you know, onto the world stage.
Moya Dodd is former vice-captain of the Matildas and current secretary to the board of the Women's League Forum. And Hans Vesterbeek, professor of international sport business at Victoria University. And next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, taking the idea of running buddies to the next level.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Children's author Andy Griffiths.
Hello.
Springsteen. He walked out and the audience sang the first verse.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, good to be here.
Where are we in space and time?
From novels that spark the imagination
to discovering music that surprises and delights.
Explore the breadth and depth of Australia's cultural landscape
with ABC Radio National.
Running a marathon, a half marathon, even a 5K is no small thing. The training, the early mornings, the commitment, it takes a lot out of you. But if you are a runner, you know the joy of being able to clear your head, feel yourself growing stronger and getting those sweet, sweet endorphins. Well, a Sydney running club is making that coveted runner's high more accessible by pairing blind and vision impaired runners with specially trained guides. One of those runners is Nicole Tillerson. Nicole is vision impaired. She's already run 4 half marathons. Nicole, welcome to Life Matters. Tell me what got you into running in the first place.
Oh, there is really nothing like that free feeling of moving at speed, is there?
Yeah. I mean, I'm very much getting the reflected glow of you as a big runner. I am not a great runner myself.
Yeah, there's just nothing like it. And I think there's also nothing like having a goal that you may or may not think you can achieve and then pushing and achieving it and learning that you're capable of doing more than you think you can and maybe more than other people think you can.
Yeah, I don't know if people immediately think of running for someone who's vision impaired. I would imagine getting started with it would be quite challenging. How'd you get into it?
Yeah. So a number of years ago, a occupational therapist was introducing me to the idea of Achilles International Running. And they told me about 2 athletes that had done some really amazing adventures, such as Kokoda and Everest. And they had no vision. And, you know, I have 10%. And I was like, wow, okay, if they can do it, I guess I can try going for a little jog. So that's how I first connected with Achilles.
If this blind hiker can get up Mount Everest, I can probably go for a 5K.
Pretty much.
You normally work with a guide dog. Was that not an option for you with running?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So my seeing eye dog Trixie is great. She's a real loomy girl. But it takes a high mental load out of the dogs to be guiding at that kind of speed, especially in a park run or an event. So Trix can definitely guide me in a 5K and can do that reasonably quickly. But as I've trained more and more, it's my PB basically is faster than hers when she's on harness. So
Trix's PB.
Yeah, true story.
So you're working with a human guide instead. What's the communication like from them? How does it compare to what you're usually getting from Trixie?
That's a really good question. So it helps that the human can talk. So with Trixie, it's using her harness and feeling her move left and right. With a guide, different people run in different ways at Achilles, but I tend to use what we call a tether, which is basically like a lanyard that you might use at work or that you might have at the bottom of a medal, so a loop of fabric, and the guide pulls it left and right to direct you. But unlike a dog, the guide can also say things like step up, step down, ramp up, ramp down, uneven surface, lift your feet. So they're able to give more information, and they, because the guide has a higher level of fitness than who they're guiding, they can just achieve more speed and more distance than Trixie's able to.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Nicole Tillerson, who is a runner. She's vision impaired. She's done 4 half marathons, no big deal, about to take on her 5th. And she works with a running guide to help her because Trixie, her guide dog, can't keep up. Basically, Nicole's too fast. One of Nicole's guides is Caroline Wong, who's also here with me today. Caroline, how'd you get into guiding?
So I live near the Botanical Gardens, which is where Achilles train. And I used to see them every Sunday training in these like bright yellow tops, and everyone just looked like they're having a really fun time. And I've been running for years and just thought it'd be a really great way to get involved and help other people achieve their fitness goals. So, yeah, I really enjoy it.
So we heard Nicole say that her guide is fitter than her, so props. What's your kind of level? Like, do you have to kind of retain a certain level of fitness to be able to be invited back?
So the club does cater for people for different levels. I think that I try to maintain a certain fitness level. It's actually really hard with winter and the rain and things like that. But they do, so like when you sort of figure out who you're going to guide, typically I think it's like your running pace plus 30 seconds to sort of figure out, because it is sort of harder to run plus talk plus kind of think about where you're going and notice potential hazards. But yeah, it does definitely add the pressure, because you do sort of think, oh shit, I don't want to let someone down when you're running along.
But also, Caroline, I think Nicole has always run with someone, right? Like she's always, I'm putting words in your mouth, Nicole, but you've always run with either a dog or a guide.
Yeah, that's right.
Caroline, for you, has running always been a partnership? Because for a lot of people, it's a very solo pursuit.
Yeah, so it really was a solo pursuit for me also. I actually preferred, like, for years running solo, even like for my training runs. I never really had a run club or anything like that. But I actually really discovered that I love running with other people. Like, it makes it more social. It makes it more chatty. Sometimes you push yourself more. And it kind of, like, almost turns into, like, a team sport. Like, I don't really care about PBs, but I love helping someone else achieve what they want to achieve. And so for me, like, that was, like, this whole other dimension that I'd sort of take it for granted, particularly for longer runs. Like, it can get quite boring running, like, 30K, 40K by yourself. So having someone else there and kind of cheering them on, it sort of forces you to think about it differently and approach it slightly differently.
Nicole?
Yeah, totally.
So, Caroline, tell me about the challenges. I'm thinking about, like, trail running, where you're, like, looking out for routes and you're navigating perhaps as you go. Is it a similar kind of challenge because you've got the mental as well as the physical?
I think so. It's also just navigating crowds and things that you sometimes don't even notice but you need to be more conscious of. So, like, tree routes is a good one, where sometimes they're marked on the road and sometimes they're not. And so the road will be uneven, and that's actually a trip hazard. But it won't necessarily be obviously uneven, but you've got to keep an eye out in case, you know, the ground slopes and the person you're guiding might trip over. So just being, like, really conscious of things like that. And then just crowds in a way in which you move amongst crowds, because you've kind of got to clear a path and make sure that people are aware of you. And that's something which is often unconscious for us, but you've kind of got to make it more conscious. Because people will sometimes move a little bit erratically also, or, like, unpredictably in those sorts of large crowds.
Oh, absolutely. Nicole, what's the most challenging facets of it for you?
I think a lot of trust is involved in the process. I mean, there's trust involved in someone guiding you when you're walking, but when you're moving at speed and as you get tired, there's just so much trust. So, yeah, it really, that is a challenge in terms of you are literally putting your life in someone's hands in the way that I put my life in Trixie's paws. But yeah, I think, you know, once you get to know your guide and you know, you see that they know their left and their right and they can, you know, they trust you, then that obstacle is gone. As Caroline said, the other obstacle is when you're doing an event in particular and people, you know, we often yell out blind runner coming through to try and help make a space for us to a piece cross kind of thing. I think that can also be a challenge, especially as people understandably like to listen to music as they're exercising, but there's a lot of noise cancelling headphones. And so that can definitely be a challenge as well for the guides and for us as well.
Yeah. How frustrating is it when people just are completely oblivious to you?
Yeah. It is a bit, I mean, you understand why they're doing it, but, as we were saying, you know, it's not really a solo venture at that point, right? Even if you're running on your own, you're still in a greater community participating in an event, whether it's the Sydney Marathon or something else.
Caroline, has it made you see running differently now that you're working with blind runners?
I don't know if it's made me see running differently. It's made me, like, see the world slightly differently in terms of just how people perceive things really differently, and that sort of makes you notice certain things in a different way. So I think it is somewhat different. I think it's brought, like, a different lens to running for me. So, like, I enjoy it in a different way when I'm guiding someone to if I'm running by myself, just because it is like a team, basically. Like, at that point, you're achieving a common goal, and I really enjoy that.
So, Nicole, this is going to be your fifth half marathon that you're gearing up for now. Have you ever thought about extending and going the full hog?
But my body, I was kind of benched from running a little while ago. So the fact my body's letting me do a half seems like a lot. It's a really hard kind of balance between respecting my body and the limitations that I have and being grateful for what I can do versus maybe pushing too far. So I'm certainly not going to rule it out, but for now, I think we'll stick to up to the half.
I mean, you're doing a lot better than, you're still lapping everyone on the couch and in many, many other distances as well. Nicole, Caroline, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Nicole Tillotson is a vision impaired runner who is about to take on her fifth half marathon. What did you do today? And Caroline Wong is her running guide because Nicole's guide dog Trixie just can't keep up anymore. Thank you so much for your texts. One person says, well done, Nicole. Anyone would be proud to run a marathon, well, half marathon, let alone multiple. Jared Clifford also shows how running is accessible to people with different needs. Of course, referring to the Australian Paralympic athlete, a vision impaired middle distance athlete. Thank you so much for your text. Kate says, my brother-in-law has Usher's syndrome. He's blind and deaf, and he regularly runs with the Achilles group in Melbourne with the support of Achilles. Simon has run several marathons and half marathons, including the Berlin Marathon, the Sydney Marathon, the Melbourne Marathon, and the New York Marathon, the latter while he unknowingly had COVID. What an inspiration. He is an incredible human being, says Kate, and an inspiration to all who know him. I'd love for you to speak with him about his experiences. Well, next, we'll explore why some of you out there are drawn to the extreme sports. How are you spending your Christmas Eve? I think the norm is to consider summer holidays as a time to be horizontal, but a lot of people will be spending their downtime seeking adrenaline. In fact, half of Aussies have tried an extreme sport. I personally love rock climbing and wild swimming, but I draw the line at jumping out of a perfectly good aeroplane. And I really want to know why some people are drawn towards what I would consider to be pretty dangerous. Do extreme sports people have less fear than the rest of us, or do they just channel their fear differently? Well, Eric Brimer is an associate professor at Southern Cross University. He studies the psychology of extreme sports and is an extreme sportsman himself. I'll let you guess what his sport of choice is. Welcome, Eric. How does the brain of a thrill seeker compare to your average punter?
I think there's a couple of similarities and obviously there's some differences too. For most extreme sports, and we're talking about real extreme sports here, where, you know, the most likely outcome of a mismanaged mistake or accident is death. The skills and expertise and knowledge they require to participate effectively most often means they have one activity that they focus on. You have to be really skilled to participate at the level they do. That doesn't mean a skier may do some mountain biking in the off season or something like that, but at the level that they're participating in, they usually just have one activity. And the kind of, you know, so you're looking at somebody who has in-depth skills and knowledge of the environment that they're participating in, as well as the activity that they're participating in.
It's really interesting because I know that you've spent a lot of time researching this, which I just love that there's research projects in this sort of thing. The dialogue around this is really like people who are crazy, they're doing crazy things. What I'm hearing you say is that really these are people who are going in with a very clear plan and quite a high skill set.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I think the idea that extreme sports athletes are risk takers, crazy people, death wish, have no fear and all those sort of things, I think that's what it used to be 20 years ago, but I think we've mostly debunked that now. The more research we do, the more we realize that that's definitely not the case. These aren't people that just sort of wake up one morning, decide, you know what, I'm going to go free climb some mountain, or I'm just going to grab one of those parachutes or take a sheep from the bed and then I'm going to jump off a cliff somewhere. These are people that spend years developing the knowledge that they require to participate in the activity that they participate in. And that's not just the same as, you know, traditional sports in the sense that they have knowledge of the actual skills required to function effectively within the sport, but they have to be able to attune to the environment too. But, you know, a base jumper standing on top of a cliff it isn't just right, I'm going to go for it. There, you have to understand the way the wind is working and all those kind of things, the way the sort of airflow is working in order to actually finally make the decision whether or not you're going to jump. And that's after you've done all the walk up to the top, and that's after you've done all the sort of get waking up early to do all those sort of things. So it is still quite possible when you get there that you read the environment and think, you know, things aren't right. But they also have to have a really in-depth understanding of themselves and their own capacities and capabilities emotionally, psychologically and physically. Because, you know, when you're doing a jump, the last thing you want to do is be in a place where you're not totally in that jump, or you're not totally in the moment on that wave. So in some ways, it kind of forces a sense of mindfulness onto you, because you're engaging with the natural world in a way that means you cannot but be totally present in that moment, totally present to the environment. So that notion of kind of crazy people doing crazy things, it just doesn't make sense when you match the kind of, you know, experience that people are having to the sort of research and the literature in this area. There's a, you know, there's an enormous mismatch there.
On the text line, Margaret says, adrenaline plus testosterone equals thrills, but adrenaline plus estrogen equals fear. What do you make of that, Eric?
It's interesting. I mean, there's lots of ways you can explore this, but I guess from an extreme sports athlete, probably the best way for me to explain this is to tell you a bit of a story. There was a base jumper I interviewed many, many years ago, and he described a time when the adrenaline did kick in. And what happens with adrenaline, all those sort of things, is that your capacities shrink in. You become much more narrow in the way you observe the world and interact with the world, and everything kind of moves inward, and things went wrong for him. He was very, very lucky in surviving. But what extreme sports athletes talk about is a sense of relaxation, a sense of calm, a sense of everything opening up, a sense of being attuned to information, the environment, as they move through the environment. So from the research that we do, that the actual lived experience and the information we capture is almost the complete opposite of what you'd expect with an adrenaline type of activity. That's not to say at the end of it something happens that looks like adrenaline, but that isn't key to the experience, and that also isn't why people continue. People continue because of that more profound sense of being human, that more profound sense of being integrated in the natural world.
And integrated in a moment, that's what I feel, at least in my chosen sport. I need to know, Eric, what your extreme sport is, because I know that you're not a couch potato.
No, it would be easy. No, I used to teach many, many years ago. My particular interest is in whitewater kayaking. So that's where I focused most of my energies when I was younger, not to the level that participants that I'm interested in understanding do by any means. I'm not world class by any means, but that's my particular interest.
He's not Jess Fox, but he is Eric Brimer. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
Eric Brimer is an associate professor at Southern Cross University and, as we just heard, a whitewater kayaker, which ties in perfectly to his research, which is the psychology of extreme sports. Well, that's it for Life Matters today on ABC Radio National. From the team here at Life Matters, I hope you and your loved ones have an amazing Christmas Day tomorrow. Today's show has been about inclusion and diversity in sport. But before I go, I want to give you a sneak peek of what you can expect from our Christmas Day program, where we will examine love and other heart conditions. Here is a sample of what you can expect.
So science has two primary ways of investigating romantic love. The first to develop was through the use of survey methods. In 1986, a pioneer named Elaine Hatfield and her co-author developed the Passionate Love Scale. Now it's basically 30 questions that ask them about features associated with romantic love, like, do you think a lot about your partner? Do you find them very beautiful? Would you be very jealous if they fell in love with someone else? These sorts of things. And there's been a whole body of research that's developed over the last 40 or so years of people administering surveys to people who are in love and comparing them with people who are not in love or just people in romantic relationships. The second thread that's come out and starting in about the year 2000 is the biopsychology. So this is mainly neuroimaging, things like functional MRIs, positron emission tomography, and electroencephalograms. These are biological means of basically picturing the brain, taking images of the brain or measuring brain waves and seeing what parts of the brain are involved. There's also endocrinological studies which basically measure hormones or neurotransmitters in blood or saliva.
So we have validated measures of romantic love, and there is definitely biological processes happening when we're in it.
Without a doubt. So the first neuroimaging study by Bartels and Zecchi was taken in 2000, and they compared people looking at pictures of their loved one compared with looking at pictures of their friends, and they found a whole constellation of brain activity associated with looking at their loved one that wasn't there when looking at their friends. It's hard to come up with the evolutionary functions of romantic love because it doesn't leave a fossil record like other things like bipedality do. But we can draw inferences from modern behaviour. And love, like all types of love, and you've got to remember there's many different types of love, maternal love, love for our pets, people love sporting teams, there's all sorts of love. All of these types of love played a role in survival of the species. And that's part of the reason why love is so intense. It's because it's really important to make sure that we can live on and procreate.
All that and more on a very special Christmas Day edition of Life Matters. And you can, of course, catch up on any of our stories today on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Life Matters and click follow so you never miss an instalment. And I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.